Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1301. Who Killed Perry Yeeky? This is being recorded on June 2nd of the year 2023. Before we get into the main body of the program, several notices slash announcements. First of all, for people who find podcasting to be the best way to consume For the Record, and that is increasingly the case, given our media landscape, sister station WFMU is podcasting For the Record, and there is a link at the SpitfireList.com website at the top of each written food for thought description, at the top of each written For the Record description, and at the top of each food for thought article that you can click on in order to subscribe to the WFMU podcasts of For the Record. Also, our brilliant contributing editor, Tara Fractal, has been basically moving mountains for quite some time. He has some excellent contributions that he makes in comments to the For the Record website. He also writes some articles as well. Also, other intelligent listeners make comments from time to time, and I encourage people emphatically to check the SpitfireList.com website that has all of Tara Fractal's comments and all of the articles he's written and the comments made by other intelligent listeners as well. There also is a 32 gigabyte flash drive that's available with everything that is on the SpitfireList.com website. All of my better part of a half a century's recorded work and written work, all of the articles and comments by Tara Fractal, plus a small mini library, well, I guess that's redundant, but a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. Everything on the SpitfireList.com website is available on a 32 gigabyte flash drive. There is a link at the top of each written For the Record description and at the top of each food for thought post that you can click on in order to get that flash drive. And I get no money whatsoever from that. And again, perhaps that is proof of my worst critic's assertions, which is that I am nuts. It's basically it's my life's work. And again, SpitfireList.com, that's the website that has all of this. And soon, that 32 gigabyte flash drive is going to be updated, including all of the work I've done on COVID and the Ukraine war as well. Now, this program is about African-American Oklahoma City policeman Perry Yeeky, a military veteran, a man who had an excellent service record on the Oklahoma City Police Force, and someone who performed heroically in the immediate aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing. He had serious questions about the official version of the story. He didn't feel that the official version was accurate. He suspected that there may have been explosive charges planted inside of the Oklahoma City bombing as well. And he began to do his own investigating on that. Eventually, he was found dead a long ways from the car in which he was allegedly drove to the place where he allegedly killed himself. He supposedly shot himself in the head, but there were cuts on his arms and on his neck. Ligature marks were observed, indicating he may have been hanged. And many people, including his family, believe he was murdered, that he did not commit suicide. I would also note that Perry Yeeky was an African-American, and his estranged wife appears to have been white, and that there are elements linked not only with the Oklahoma City bombing, the white supremacist elements who would have looked very gravely askance at such a situation, but that may have overlapped what happened to Perry Yeeky. That is an interrogatory element. Certainly, the official account of his, quote, suicide, unquote, does not hold water. And we are going to go into not only his behavior with regard to the Oklahoma City bombing, but also the circumstances surrounding his, quote, suicide, unquote. It's also worth noting that he referred to a particular place outside of Oklahoma City as a place where bad things happened. It's not specified what those were. I wonder if perhaps what was taking place there were lynchings, which were not uncommon in Oklahoma once upon a time. The article that we are going to read into the record comes from CNN, and this is from CNN of March 3rd of 2023. It is on their website, and the article is by Thomas Lake, L-A-K-E, of CNN. The article is titled, "Why Did This Cop Turn Up Dead?" Subtitled, "A Heroic Police Officer Rescued At Least Three People After the 1995 Oklahoma City Bombing. A Year Later, He Was Found Shot in the Head." We have the article reads as follows. "The bombing memorial is a somber and beautiful place framed by two monuments called the Gates of Time. The 901 gate commemorates the innocents before the explosion, which happened at 9:02 a.m., and became known as the deadliest act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history. The 903 gate represents, quote, the moment healing began, unquote. But some survivors never healed. With time, their suffering only got worse. This story is about one of those people. His name was Terry Yeakey, first name capital P-E-R-R-Y, last name capital Y-E-A-K-E-Y. I may be mispronouncing the last name. Continuing. He was an Oklahoma City police officer and a military veteran. Yeakey saved at least three people from the ruins of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building on April 19, 1995, the day a terrorist attack killed 168 people and injured hundreds of others. Something happened to Yeakey in those hours in the wreckage. He was badly shaken, and his worldview seemed to change. In time, he grew suspicious and afraid. He ran afoul of his supervisors. He went on secret missions, withholding his motives and plans from fellow officers. He seemed to be conducting his own investigation. And then, 385 days after the bombing, his body was found near some trees in a field off a country road. His wrists were cut. His neck was cut. He'd been shot through the head. The authorities said it was suicide, but among those who knew Terry Yeakey, not many believed he had killed himself. In a recent interview, his sister, LaShawn Hargrove, H-A-R-G-R-O-V-E, said this, quote, "I think they murdered Terry because he knew too much," unquote. Despite his bravery that day, Yeakey did not see himself as a hero. Even among those who disagree on how Terry Yeakey died, there is little or no dispute on these two points. One, the Oklahoma City Police Department planned to give him a Medal of Valor for his actions on the day of the bombing. Two, Yeakey did not want the Medal of Valor. Much of this story hinges on why he didn't want the medal. But by any reasonable standard, he deserved it. Not long after the explosion, a maintenance worker lay under the rubble, willing himself to stay alive. Excuse me, one more time. Not long after the explosion, a maintenance worker lay under the rubble, willing himself to stay conscious. His name was Randy Ledger. Broken glass had pierced his carotid artery and his jugular vein. Part of his face was missing. Ledger had been cleaning light fixtures in the Federal Building's child care center a few minutes before the bomb went off. Now, trapped by debris and bleeding to death, Ledger felt a strange weight on his lower body. He was buried so deeply that someone had stepped on his legs without knowing he was there. That someone turned out to be Yiki, the police officer who was about to save his life. Yiki was 29 years old, tall and muscular, well known among colleagues for his strength and determination. On his way to pick up a partner on a burglary in progress call one day, his patrol car broke down. It was over 100 degrees outside, but Yiki got out and ran the rest of the way. Another time, when an angry crowd surrounded Yiki and a colleague, and the ringleader tried to grab the other officer's badge, Yiki picked up the suspect, quote, wadded him up like a paper napkin, and threw him on the ground, unquote. The other officer, Larry Spruill, S-P-R-U-I-L-L, recalled. The rest of the mob quickly dispersed. Yiki was one of the first officers in the ruins of the federal building after the explosion, and he'd already saved at least two other people before he stumbled upon Randy Ledger. Yiki called for other rescuers, and together they dug Ledger out and helped him onto a backboard. Ledger drifted out of consciousness. Minutes later, in the ambulance, he saw Yiki again. Now, Yiki was getting treated too. He'd fallen and hurt his back while carrying Ledger to safety. Ledger needed 12 pints of blood and multiple surgeries to repair his face. He recently turned 66, and he still thinks of the bombing almost every day. Little things bring the memory back. A musty smell, a news report, a yellow truck on the highway, and when Ledger recalls the bombing, he sometimes thinks of Terry Yiki. He feels gratitude and sadness. As for the official story that Yiki killed himself, Ledger finds it unconvincing. Quote, there's too many unanswered questions, unquote, he said recently. Brandon Spann, that's capital B-R-A-N-D-O-N, last name capital S-P-A-M-N, now an administrative assistant at the Canadian County Sheriff's Office, played basketball with Yiki and knew many of the same people Yiki knew. He said that in the black community of El Reno, a town northwest of Oklahoma City where Yiki grew up, the official story never took hold. Quote, no one believed that he killed himself, unquote, Spann said. Three of Yiki's fellow Oklahoma City police officers also shared their bouts in interviews with CNN. Jim Ramsey, R-A-M-S-E-Y, won the Medal for Bravery on the day of the bombing and had previously patrolled the streets with Yiki. Here's how he responded in late 2022 when asked if he believed what the authorities said about Yiki's death. No, Ramsey said. I guess I don't. Quote, I still don't believe Terry did it, unquote, said Steve Vassar, one of Yiki's closest friends on the force. I had just a hard time believing that Terry would take his life, unquote. Don Browning, B-R-O-W-N-I-N-G, served the Oklahoma City Police Department for 28 years and helped with Yiki's initial police training. Here's what Browning said about Yiki, quote, I still think he was murdered, unquote. They found blood in Yiki's car, but no autopsy was conducted on his body. A CNN investigation found several anomalies surrounding Yiki's death, along with a lack of transparency by the authorities. And the next, the article goes into some of those anomalies. Although Yiki apparently died from a gunshot wound to the head, no autopsy was performed. That is suspicious, by the way. When a cop dies of an apparent gunshot wound, you would expect an autopsy to be performed. One more time. Although Yiki apparently died from a gunshot wound to the head, no autopsy was performed. Medical examiners can sometimes choose not to perform an autopsy when suicide is suspected and the cause of death is not in dispute, according to Dr. Joyce, DeJong, D-E, and then the capital J-O-N-G, president of the National Association of Medical Examiners. But three former law enforcement officials familiar with the Yeeky case said they thought an autopsy should have been done. When asked why there was no autopsy on Yeeky, an Oklahoma City Police Department spokesman, Master Sergeant Gary Knipe, capital K-N-I-G-H-P, referred a reporter to the State Medical Examiner's Office, whose Director of Operations, Carrie Learned, that's K-A-R-I, last name L-E-A-R-N-E-D, wrote, quote, "Our office does not answer specific questions." Actually, one but my friend. "Our office does not answer case-specific questions." The Oklahoma City Police Department took over the investigation of Yeeky's death, even though his body was found outside the city limits in adjacent Canadian County to the west. When CNN asked what gave the city's police department legal justification to take over the case, Knight wrote back that he didn't know. The precise location where Yeeky's body was found has never been publicly disclosed, and basic information about the death scene is unclear. The police department declined multiple requests to release its full investigative report on the case. The redacted two-page report released by OCPD in response to CNN's records request does not say whether a gun was found at the scene, much less what kind of gun killed Yeeky, or whether it was subjected to fingerprinting or ballistics tests. Both Knight and Police Chief Wade Gurley declined to be interviewed about Yeeky's death. Quote, "There is absolutely no hard or physical evidence whatsoever to support Yeeky was murdered," unquote. Knight, a police academy classmate who considered Yeeky a friend, wrote in an email to CNN, quote, "Anyone who suggests the Oklahoma City Police Department participated in the cover-up of the murder of one of its most popular officers is engaging in fool's folly," unquote. Doesn't answer why the Oklahoma City Police Department would be handling an investigation, although into an Oklahoma City police officer's death, it was outside of Oklahoma City. Continuing. Yeeky's car, a maroon Ford Probe Coupe, was found abandoned on Fort Reno Road in Canadian County around 6 p.m. on May 8, 1996, according to a sheriff's report. The car was locked, and the windows were rolled up. A deputy looked inside and saw a Bible, an empty gun holster, a razor blade, and a, quote, "large amount of blood," unquote. Yeeky's body was eventually found about half a mile away, the police said. A medical examiner's report noted, quote, "multiple superficial incised wounds," unquote, to Yeeky's wrists, neck, and antecubital fossa, the inner crook of the arm. Although there was no autopsy, the report listed a probable cause of death: gunshot wound to head. If the prevailing narrative is correct, Yeeky cut his own wrists, arms, and neck with razor blades, bled heavily in his car, and then walked or ran about half a mile into either a field or a grove of trees where he shot himself to death. There was no suicide note. The absence of a note was among several reasons people wondered what might have pushed Yeeky toward suicide. In statements to the news media after his death, the police had two answers for that. One possible factor was turmoil in Yeeky's personal life. He had been married with two young daughters, but he and his wife Tanya divorced in late 1995. In court records, Tanya wrote that Perry had beaten her, choked her, and threatened to shoot her, himself, and one of their daughters. She had repeatedly applied for protective orders against him, and in February of 1995, about 15 months before Perry's death, a judge had ordered Perry to have no contact with Tanya, quote, except regarding visitation and the welfare, unquote, of their daughters. Did the repercussions from domestic violence play a role in Yiki's death? Yiki's friend and colleague Steve Vassar, V-A-S-S-A-R, told CNN he once read Oklahoma City Police Department's full investigative report on Yiki's death. According to Vassar, the report said Major Steve Upchurch called Yiki shortly before his death, told him Tanya had reported him for violating the protective order, told Yiki he was being placed on administrative leave, and told Yiki another officer was coming to take away Yiki's gun and badge. But even if Vassar correctly remembers what was in the report, which has never been released, those details are contested. Major Upchurch, UPCHURCH, told CNN in a phone interview he had no recollection of making such a call to Yiki. He said he didn't remember Yiki making any trouble with his ex-wife before his death, and he said he didn't remember anything about Yiki being in trouble with his superiors. Besides that, Tanya vehemently denied reporting him for a protective order violation in 1996. In interviews with the author Craig Roberts, the tapes of which were reviewed by CNN, Tanya Yiki said she and Perry Yiki were on good terms before his death. She said they regularly saw each other, and he had recently asked her about getting remarried. She had not said yes, but she had not said no. If Yiki's death was unrelated to a troubled relationship or to fears of losing his job, that left another potential cause, If Yiki's death was unrelated to a troubled relationship or to fears of losing his job, that left another potential cause put forth to the news media by the police department. Yiki was depressed about the bombing. News coverage after Yiki's death depicted a man haunted by what he'd seen in the rubble and racked with guilt that he couldn't save more lives. Quote, there are some people that like to be heroes and some that don't, unquote, one of Yiki's supervisors, Lieutenant Joe Ann Randall, said as quoted by the Associated Press in 1996. He was not one that wanted that, unquote. Why didn't Perry Yiki want the Medal of Valor? There was another possible reason. And for those who said he was murdered, that reason was a crucial part of the story. They're not telling the truth, Yiki said. In a brief phone conversation last November, Yiki's ex-wife Tanya told CNN she still believed Yiki had been murdered. Then she stopped answering the reporter's calls. But Tanya's story was captured in 1998 in two recorded interviews with Craig Roberts, a former police officer who was researching the Oklahoma City bombing. One was a private phone interview, and the other was for a radio broadcast. After reviewing the tapes, CNN found corroboration for some of Tanya's claims. On the day of the bombing, Tanya said, she got a phone call. It was someone at Presbyterian Hospital telling her Terry was there. His back was injured when he fell while carrying Randy Ledger, and now Perry needed someone to pick him up. So Tanya picked him up from the hospital. And in the car, she says, he started to cry. Tanya, it's not what they're saying it is, he told her. They're not telling the truth. They're lying about what's going on down there, unquote. Perry was disturbed by what he'd seen in the ruins of the building, and not just because he'd walked into an unfathomable human tragedy. Perry was convinced there was more to the story of the bombing, some other piece the authorities were withholding. He was not the only one who believed this. Federal authorities said Timothy McVeigh, 26, one more time. Federal authorities said Timothy McVeigh, a 26-year-old Army veteran who hated the government, caused the explosion by parking a rented Ryder truck near the federal building and setting off pine fuses that detonated the bomb made of, quote, agricultural fertilizer, diesel fuel, and other chemicals, unquote. Two more men, Perry Nichols and Michael Fortier, F-O-R-T-I-E-R, were also prosecuted in connection with the case. FBI agents and local police escort, one more time. In the months and years that followed, a stubborn contingent of skeptics pursued other angles to the story. Some of them had either survived the bombing or lost loved ones because of it. They insisted that no government officials were somehow culpable. It was a botched sting operation, they said, or perhaps the government permitted or even orchestrated the bombing for political advantage. The government denied these allegations, of course, and still does. Quote, this was probably the FBI's finest moment, unquote, Bob Ricks, who was special agent in charge of the FBI's Oklahoma City field office in 1995, said in a recent interview referring to the bombing investigation. Still, there is something about the case that makes people want to keep investigating. There were multiple reports of prior warnings given to some federal employees of an unidentified second suspect in the Ryder truck. More about John Doe number 2 later. And of additional explosives that allegedly contributed to the blast. Ricks said those reports were false and started laughing when a reporter asked about them. But in 1997, more than 10,000 Oklahoma County Oklahoma County residents signed a petition to convene a grand jury to examine the bombing. Take three. But in 1997, more than 10,000 Oklahoma County residents signed a petition to convene a grand jury to examine the bombing. Even after the grand jury dismissed allegations of additional suspects and prior knowledge by the government, a band of citizens kept digging into the mystery. Led by former Oklahoma State Representative Charles Key, K-E-Y, the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee issued its own report, which filled more than 500 pages and told a story at odds with the one that emerged at McVeigh's trial. Explosives experts, including retired Air Force Brigadier General Benton Partin, P-A-R-P-I-N, reviewed the case and said McVeigh's bomb alone could not have caused that much damage. Quote, there is strong evidence that demolition charges were in the building, unquote, Partin wrote in a letter to a prosecutor in 1997, again quoting, irrespective of the size of the truck bomb, unquote. For his part, Perry Yeakey believed some government employees had lied about their whereabouts during the bombing. Associates said Yeakey was surprised to see so many federal agents apparently dressed in riot gear on the scene moments after the blast. And he had questions about the source of the explosion. According to his sister, LaShawn Hargrove, quote, you know how they said the truck bomb blew in? He saw evidence of blowing out, unquote, or signs of a blast that appeared to have come from inside the building. A few days after the bombing, Tanya said, Terry asked her to drive him back to the federal building. He wanted to go at night when he couldn't be seen as easily. Quote, we did go down there, probably between 9:30, 10 o'clock, and he said that we were going to go look underneath where the daycare had been, she said. There was something he wanted to see over there and get a picture, if possible. As we went down there, we were stopped, and I can't remember which personnel it was, but I know definitely it was either ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or FBI, and Perry had attempted to badge his way through, and the guy told him no. And he said something a little more specific, like, you know, you're not supposed to be back down here, unquote. It made me realize the two of them recognized each other and the interaction was very antagonistic. I think had I not been with Perry, he would have said a little more to the man and maybe been a little more forceful about getting through. But it seemed like he thought better about it since I was with him, and we left, unquote. Palmier says Perry wrote a detailed report for the police department, perhaps 9 pages long. She didn't know what was in the report. But one day he came to the house, furious, telling her the report had disappeared. And now his superiors were telling him to write another report, only 1 page long, leaving out most of what he'd written before. About 2 weeks after the bombing, she says, she got a phone call from one of Perry's supervisors. Now, again, there is a basic methodological consideration here. The brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Bale Scott noted that, quote, the cover-up obviates the conspiracy, unquote. And why the report apparently disappeared, at least according to Periyiki, why would the report disappear? That does not make sense in and of itself. It would, however, if there was material in the report that somehow contradicted the official version of the case. Resuming with the reading of the article. About 2 weeks after the bombing, she says she got a phone call from one of Perry's superiors. Quote, and she was getting pretty hostile, pretty aggressive, and asked me where Perry was, unquote. Panya said, again quoting, she said, you tell Perry that if he doesn't get that other report in, that he's going to be reprimanded, unquote. Did an officer's report on the bombing disappear? A spokesman for the Oklahoma City Police Department declined to answer this or other questions on an extensive list sent by CNN. Knight said most of the questions on the list were requests for material that were, quote, not an open record, unquote. Why wouldn't they answer? If the report didn't disappear, why wouldn't they answer that question? And if it did disappear, why did it disappear? Continuing. But Tommy's account is consistent with a story another Oklahoma City police officer told. Steve Vassar, V-A-S-S-A-R, said he was downtown a few minutes before the bombing and saw the infamous Ryder truck. Officially, Timothy McVeigh was alone when he drove the truck for the federal building. But others have said he had an accomplice that morning, and Vassar said he saw another person in the truck. Quote, I'm going to tell you right now, he said, as God is my witness, there were two people, unquote. Vassar says that although he, one more time, Vassar says that although he wrote this account in one of his supplemental reports on the bombing, no investigator ever questioned him about what he'd seen. Years later, he searched for his reports of the Oklahoma City, one more time, years later, he searched for his reports in the Oklahoma City Police Department's computer system. He says he saw hundreds of other reports about the bombing and its aftermath, but he couldn't find his own reports. Again, why? They were gone, he said. They were not in the system, as if I never was there, unquote. On the day he died, Yiki said he was on his way to a mysterious meeting. In his final weeks, Perry seemed afraid. Panya said he showed up at her house at odd hours, trying to make plans. Quote, he wanted me to leave in the middle of the night with him, she said. Right then, he said, quote, we need to get remarried. Don't ask me questions. This is the only way I can make sure you and the girls are taken care of in the event that something happens to me, unquote. Pamya says she reported his behavior to the police. He did not appear suicidal, and she did not accuse him of violating a protective order, she said, but she was worried about him because he'd been saying his days were numbered. One day in May of 1996, he showed up at her house and put the VCR in her car without explaining why. The VCR had a tape in it, but she didn't get a chance to watch it. Perry was talking about insurance papers. He left and said he would be back. She never saw him again. Shortly before his death, Perry also visited his sister Vicky and her husband Glenn in El Reno, the town northwest of Oklahoma City, where Perry and Vicky grew up. Vicky and Glenn have both died since then, but another sister, LaShawn Hargrove, said they told her about the encounter. Perry was exhausted, upset, crying. He said he needed to sleep, and they encouraged him to take a nap there, which he did. Afterwards, he calmed down, but he was talking about the bombing and the official story with which he disagreed. According to LaShawn, he told his sister and brother-in-law, quote, "It's just not what they say it is," unquote. They asked him to tell them more, but he said he couldn't. There was someone else Perry saw near the end, Ramona McDonald, whom he'd met in the rubble of a federal building. This account is drawn from an interview she gave CNN in January, as well as a taped interview with the author Craig Roberts in 1998. McDonald eventually left Oklahoma City and changed her name, a decision she attributed in part to trauma related to the bombing and to Yiki's death. McDonald was a businesswoman who'd been downtown when the bomb went off. She helped publish a book, Angels Over Oklahoma City, that named and honored hundreds of first responders from around the country who converged in Oklahoma City after the bombing. While volunteering in the rescue and recovery effort, McDonald also met supervisors who questioned the official story. Her home became a meeting place for those people and a clearinghouse for pictures and other evidence they gathered. She said that evidence included a copy of Perry Yiki's full report from the day of the bombing, the one his supervisors had allegedly suppressed. According to McDonald, two men came to her house sometime after the bombing. She believed they were federal agents. They said they were with a task force that was investigating the bombing, and they spent hours examining her collection of pictures. The last day McDonald saw Yiki, she says, they sat down and had coffee together. She was talking about an appointment. One more time. The last day McDonald saw Yiki, she says, they sat down and had coffee together. He was talking about an appointment. From his description of the men he was supposed to meet, she believed they were the same two men who'd been at her house. The men from the task force seemed keenly interested in the evidence about the bombing. They wanted Perry to bring what he'd gathered, pictures, video, documents. Yiki seemed conflicted about whether to go meet the men. He sensed danger, and these misgivings led him to take a strange precaution. McDonald said Yiki went to the meeting unarmed, so no one would use his own gun against him. On the other hand, if the men really were investigating the bombing, this could be Yiki's big chance. Finally, someone with authority was going to listen to him. He decided to bring them the evidence, McDonald said. The men wanted to meet Yiki in El Reno at or near the federal prison. Yiki left McDonald's house apparently on his way to the meeting. She never saw him again. It was later that day when someone called to say he was dead. His body was found west of El Reno, about 2 miles from the federal prison. It is a lonely, windswept place with tall grass under a big sky. Past the barbed wire fence off Fort Reno Road, where Yiki's car was found, a stream runs north and east toward a grove of trees and an old graveyard. Tanya said Perry would never have gone there willingly. He knew that land, and it made him afraid. Quote, "I remember him at one point in time saying that lots of bad things went on over there," unquote, she said. Again, quoting, "he wouldn't have been caught," I was getting ready to say, "he wouldn't have been caught dead there." But I guess he was. and then, according to Mama, they executed him. Periyiki's body was found on a Wednesday night. By Thursday morning, an Oklahoma City police captain had already told the Associated Press it appeared Yiki had killed himself. That was almost 27 years ago. Ever since then, Yiki's death has been officially called a suicide. Tanya said she met with the police chief and told him she disagreed with that conclusion. She said she tried without success to arrange for an autopsy. She said local attorneys refused to take her case. She said one told her, quote, "It would be best for me and my family just to leave it alone," unquote. LaShawn Hargrove said that when she and her sister met with a police detective and raised questions about their brother's death, the detective suggested they needed psychiatric help. Don Browning, one of the officers who questioned the circumstances of Yiki's death, was especially disturbed by the lack of an autopsy. Quote, "How dare you not do an autopsy on an unattended death on a police officer?" unquote. He said, according to Browning, he appeared before the grand jury investigating the bombing and confronted the prosecutor about the strange details of Yiki's death. Browning said the prosecutor dismissed him and apparently took no action in the case. Craig Roberts, a former Marine sniper who later became a Tulsa police officer and book author, stumbled upon the Yiki case while looking into the Oklahoma City bombing. He wrote letters asking the Oklahoma City Police Department to open a new investigation into Yiki's death. Quote, "Though it was originally written up as a suicide," unquote, he wrote in 2006, "I feel the evidence and facts point to a torture, homicide," unquote. Roberts wrote that Yiki's entrance wound suggested the presence of a silencer. He wrote that the bullet's trajectory, quote, "would be consistent to one fired," quote, "execution style into the skull of a kneeling victim." He wrote, quote, "There were multiple cuts on his wrists, inner elbows, and jugular veins. If he was going to shoot himself, why would he cut himself so many times?" unquote. Also, I think one would ask, why was his body found a half mile from his car? And if he did indeed not bring his service weapon to the meeting that he had because he didn't want his own gun to be used on him, where was the weapon that took his life? Continuing with the article. About a month later, Police Chief William City, CITTY, wrote back to Roberts, quote, "I find nothing in the investigator's case files or from the information you have provided that changes the finding of suicide," unquote. The chief did not answer the questions Roberts raised in his letter, including whether a gun was found at the scene, whether it was Yiki's gun, whether the fatal bullet was ever found, or whether any ballistics tests were done to link the bullet and the gun. The Roberts letter also raised the question of what happened to Perry Yiki's documents after he died. Tanya said Perry kept some documents from his investigation at a storage unit in Kingfisher, a small city northwest of Oklahoma City, but, quote, "Whatever was there is not there any longer," unquote. Roberts said the documents were not in Yiki's car when it was found by the roadside. Quote, "It would appear that this tragic event centers on what Perry Yiki had in his files," Roberts wrote to the police chief, "and who wanted to make sure those files were never discovered," unquote. After Perry's death, Tanya said she saw signs of a burglary at her home. She noticed various items out of place. Perry had left a VCR for her, but it disappeared. She never got a chance to see what was on the tape. Likewise, Ramona McDonald said her house was burglarized after Yiki's death. Much of her bombing-related evidence was taken. When Perry's family visited his apartment after his death, It looked as if it had been ransacked. There was paper scattered around, her sister LaShawn said, and quote, you could tell somebody had been in there, like, looking for something, unquote. Both LaShawn and Tanya believed they were under surveillance after Perry's death. They said they were shadowed by strange vehicles, and they heard clicking sounds when they talked on the phone. Shortly after Perry's death, several relatives went looking for the place his body had been discovered. LaShawn says they found it near some trees in a field past a barbed wire fence off Fort Reno Road. There were signs of activity on the ground, as if this had been a crime scene, but they noticed something strange. Some of the earth was freshly disturbed, apparently by shovels, as if whatever had been on the surface was now buried. Most troubling of all was the condition of Perry's body. Although the available medical examiner's reports described only a gunshot wound to the head and superficial cuts elsewhere, Tanya said sources within the law enforcement community told her Perry's body showed evidence of having either been tied or handcuffed and of having been dragged across the ground. She said she was told Perry had bruises on his wrists, rope burns on his ankles, dirt and grass in his wounds. CNN asked the Oklahoma City Police Department about these details, but a department spokesman declined to answer the question. One more time. CNN asked the Oklahoma City Police Department about these details, but a department spokesman declined to answer the questions. LaShawn Hargrove said her mother viewed Perry's body at the funeral home. She said a funeral director tried to discourage her from looking at the body, but her mother said, quote, no, I need to see my baby, unquote. On the day of his funeral, Yiki posthumously received the Medal of Valor. Her mother, who has since died, later told LaShawn that Perry's head was enlarged and disfigured, and he didn't just have cuts on his arms and neck. LaShawn said her mother reported seeing what appeared to be ligature marks. LaShawn tried to imagine what that meant. It seemed to her that Perry had been tortured, hanged, put on his knees, and shot to death. Mama, she recalled saying, they executed him, unquote. Sergeant Peretz Yiki was buried the same day he posthumously received the Medal of Valor he did not want. Among those at his funeral was Richard Williams, a man whose life he saved. After the bombing, Williams was trapped in the rubble with only his arms sticking out. Yiki came by, felt for a pulse, did not detect one, and moved on to look for other survivors. Later he returned, realized Williams was alive, freed him from the wreckage, and brought him to safety. Then he went on to his next rescue. A picture taken that morning shows the officer in action. He has sweat on his brow, blood on his shirt, dust on his shoes. Terry Yiki is running toward the danger. There are many things about the account given here that are suggestive of Perry Yiki being murdered and of a cover-up. The burglaries, both apparently at Tanya's place, at Ramon and McDonald's place, the apparent search, the disruption at Perry Yiki's own apartment, the surveillance and alleged tapping that people felt they were being subjected to, and also the disappearing reports, not only Perry Yiki's report, but also Speed Vasher's report, and the many odd accounts of the actual circumstances of his death. If he didn't bring his own gun to the scene because he was afraid it would be used on him, where was the murder weapon? And what was the murder weapon? Why were there multiple cuts on Perry Yiki's body? Why was his body found about a half mile from where his car was parked. It was in a place where he would not have gone in and of himself. And again, there are many very suspicious aspects of the case I've highlighted, but few of them. And in connection with the Oklahoma City bombing itself, there are many, many questions. I initially was not that open to considerations that there was a second explosive device in the building itself that also helped to bring it down, mostly due to the fact that the elements that were bruiting that about were mostly people saying, well, it was the government that did it. And the government said, well, it was Lone Nut, Timothy McVeigh, but also Terry McNichols and others. One of the things that I wonder about, and this will perhaps, I'll just say this very briefly, in examining the assassination of JFK, the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address that Lee Harvey Oswald used for his Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature, and that was obviously serving as something of an intelligence center for the Guy Bannister and his associates, also was an epicenter of right-wing activity, specifically far-right activity. Bannister had strong links to the American Nazi Party, as allegedly did his secretary, Earlene Roberts. One of the questions that is interesting in connection with Operation Stay Behind or Operation Gladio, this was the NATO operation in which far-right and fascist elements were recruited in order to provide a stay-behind army to either disrupt the government in the event of a communist takeover via electoral means, or to combat the Red Army in case of a successful invasion of Western Europe. If, in fact, every NATO country had a stay-behind contingent, that apparently excluded the largest and most important NATO country, which was the U.S., obviously, the U.S. wasn't going to get invaded from a foreign country, but given the orientation of elements like the John Birch Society and many similarly minded individuals, they were worried about what they considered to be a communist takeover. And indeed, they viewed, quote, liberals, unquote, as communists, and it was not unusual for elements within the federal intelligence and law enforcement establishment to see the civil rights movement itself as a communist-inspired movement. One of the things I wonder about in connection with the Kennedy assassination was the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address, basically also serving as an epicenter for a domestic stay-behind operation. I talk about that in For the Record programs 188 and 971. Another very interesting question is that Steve Vassar says he saw two suspects in the Ryder truck. There were many accounts in the wake of the bombing that saw Timothy McVeigh in the company of a John Doe number 2. And a composite sketch of John Doe number 2 has a very strong resemblance to a guy named Andreas Strassmeyer. He was a former Bundeswehr intelligence officer and also the son of Günter Strassmeyer, who was Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the architect of German reunification. He was also the grandson of one of the founding members of the NSDAP, the German Nazi Party under Adolf Hitler. According to Carol Howe, an undercover APF informant, Andreas Strassmeyer was the actual mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing, and Timothy McVeigh was his protege. Strassmeyer was a security coordinator at a white supremacist compound called Elohim City in Oklahoma. And when subjected to a polygraph examination, Carol Howe passed the three-needle polygraph. If in fact Andreas Strassmeyer was the mastermind of the bombing, and if Timothy McVeigh was his protege, that would have placed not only a German national in the defendant's dock and subject to the death penalty, that does not exist in Europe, but it also, if it were properly pursued, might very well have shed light on what I call the Underground Reich. And I suspect that may very well, the presence of Andrea Strassmeyer in the investigation may very well have led to the cover-up. First of all, he would have been subject to the death penalty. That wouldn't have gone over well in Europe. But beyond that, it would have shed a lot of light upon what really has been going on behind the scenes. There also are many evidentiary tributaries leading between the Oklahoma City bombing and other Paris incidents. A Filipino law enforcement officer named Edwin Angeles described being at a meeting in which Terry Nichols, a man who called himself the farmer, was present at a meeting with, among others, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first Oklahoma City bombing, of the first World Trade Center attack in 1993. In, for the record, programs 1181 and 1182, we took a look at the evidentiary tributaries between the first attack on the World Trade Center and the 9/11 attacks. Gunter, the same Andreas Strassmeyer was allegedly looking for a surplus Lufthansa Boeing 747. The question is, why? You're not going to land that on a remote dirt airstrip. Why was Andreas Strassmeyer looking for a surplus Boeing 747? It also was a very important article written by Jim Krogan called The Terrorist Motel. Many people report at a motel outside of Oklahoma City seeing Timothy McVeigh not only in the presence of the 20th hijacker, Mr. Moussaoui. I mean, maybe his name was Andreas Moussaoui. Anyway, Mr. Moussaoui, but also saw him in the company, allegedly, of Mohammed Atta. This has never been explained and has never been looked into. So the point being that the Oklahoma City bombing may very well have had more to it than what we are told. If, in fact, elements of the far right and explicit Nazi elements were involved with the federal government, the notion of a botched sting makes sense there too. If in fact there were a bomb in the Ryder van, as there certainly appears to have been, and if in fact law enforcement officers descended on that, the second bomb inside of the building, if in fact there was such a bomb, might very well have been intended to kill those officers. Again, this is all obviously what I call food for thought and grounds for research. But there certainly appears to have been much more to the Oklahoma City bombing than what we have been told. And I think the, quote, suicide, unquote, of Terry Geeky really should have been investigated much more than it should have been. And he appears to have been a martyred hero. Remember, there are links at the top of each written for the record description and each food for thought post that will enable you to subscribe to the WFMU podcast for the record. There are links at the top, again, of every written for the record description and at each food for thought post that will enable you to subscribe to obtain the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my life's work on it and the library of old anti-fascist books. That was going to be updated shortly. And again, I get no money from that flash drive. And also, do check the SpitfireList.com website on a regular basis for the comments made by Terrafractal. This concludes For the Record program number 1301, Who Killed Terry Geeky, being recorded on June 2nd of the year 2023. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.